The Hand of Robin Squires, Chapter 14. When I first felt that cold, wet nose on my forehead, I opened my eyes and jumped up, all in one motion. I stood blinking in the sunlight, wondering if I had been dreaming. Then I began to laugh, for standing in front of me was a dog, and a small dog at that. But what was a dog doing here? I thought there were only wild animals in North America, bear, moose, deer, and the like. Yet this creature looked every inch a dog. He was a short-haired brown animal with pointed ears and a bushy tail that was wagging. But this was only the first of many surprises. I heard a voice. "Miko," it said. "Miko." The dog turned and ran toward the woods. At that moment, a tall, dark-haired youth appeared from the trees and stood looking at me. I felt a wonderful surge of unexpected pleasure and excitement. Not 50 yards from me was what I had in my first imaginings of North America always hoped to see, an Indian, one of the inhabitants of this new land. And I could not have met one more handsome or more impressive. He was young, about my age, but taller and much more strongly built. His skin was reddish brown, his eyes black, his hair dark and glossy. He stood regarding me as curiously as I did him. When I got over my astonishment, it occurred to me that he might not be alone, and that if there were others around, I might very well be in some danger. I had heard that Indians were known for their quick ambushes. Torn between wanting to meet him and my common sense, which told me to return to the ship, I decided to compromise and swim back to the island, hoping he would follow me there. I had waded only a few feet into the water when he called after me. "Wait," he shouted. I stopped in my tracks, wondering if I had heard correctly. "Wait," he repeated. I turned around. He strode across the sand toward me and stuck out his hand. "You stay," he said. I took his hand and shook it dumbly, still feeling myself in some kind of a trance. "You speak English," I said. "How did you learn?" He shrugged. "White trader tell me many words." I was intrigued. Was this coastline not so deserted as my uncle thought? "What traders?" I asked. "Summer passed. Come on ship to our village. Stay long time. They trade. We talk." "Are they there now?" He shook his head. "Where is your village?" He waved down the coast. "A day in canoe," he said. "Why are you here then, if you live that far away?" My knowledge of Indians was so slight that I did not know that 50 miles was little more than a routine hike. "Good place for eels," he explained, pointing beyond the rocky promontory that elbowed itself into the sea. Then, as if he had decided that he had answered enough questions, he jabbed a finger at my chest and said, "Why you here?" The question caught me off guard. I knew I shouldn't tell him about Edward's treasure or the vault he intended to build on the island. "We came on a ship," I said, and let it go at that. "To trade?" "No, no," I said quickly, "not to trade, to build something." He frowned. "What you build?" This Indian was more curious and quick than any boy I had ever met. Moreover, there was about him a directness, which made lying to him almost impossible. So I told the truth, deliberately using difficult words so that he would not understand completely. "We are constructing a shaft and tunnel to conceal my uncle's unlawful gains," I said. Another frown. Then he changed the subject. "Your name?" he asked. "Robin." "Robin," he repeated. "And yours?" "Actodon." It took several attempts for me to get my tongue around it. We were still standing at the water's edge. Actodon slipped off his moccasins and threw them onto the sand, then waded into the water. "Come, Robin," he said. "You teach me to swim." "Teach you to swim?" I said. "Don't you know how to swim?" With all the water around, it seemed incredible to me that I, who had grown up with only a stream nearby, could swim and he could not. "No," he said simply, "my people not swim." Then he tapped his chest. "I do." Although when he said those words, they were not exactly true. They were soon were. It was plain to see that the reason Actodon hadn't been able to swim was because he had not learned to relax in the water. He fought it instead, flailing and thrashing his arms and legs until he sank like a stone, simply from the exertion of trying to stay afloat. "Pretend you are going to sleep," I said to him. "Lie back and move slowly. The sea will keep you up." Indeed, the salt water was far more buoyant than the water in the Shilston stream where I learned. After an hour or two, Actodon was floating and kicking his body across the channel. He was doing it so well that he was reluctant to leave the water long after I had had enough. My back was beginning to smart from too much sun. I knew my fair skin would be an angry red tomorrow, if not sooner. "My back hurts," I called to Actodon. "I'm putting my clothes on." "Wait," he said, and waded ashore. He looked at my back and then headed up the beach, where he disappeared behind the rocks. Within minutes, he was back with a small pouch. He opened it and proceeded to smear some rank, evil-smelling liquid on my back. "What is that?" I held my nose. He laughed. "Bear grease. Good for skin. I think it works only because the smell is so bad you forget about your sunburn." "Flies don't bite," he said. "No wonder," I thought, but said no more. Actodon obviously considered this a favor. After he had finished, he said, "We eat." "My food is on the other side." I pointed to the sack and the pile of clothes on the opposite shore. "Go in canoe," he said, and went round the rocks again, reappearing in the canoe, which he deftly maneuvered across the channel towards my belongings. Once there, he jumped out, picked up my things, and paddled back toward me. All the while, Miko sat alert and motionless in the bow, like a small carved figurehead. As soon as the canoe was beached, however, the little dog jumped out and rolled back and forth on the sand, mostly from relief that at long last his young master was finished with the water. "Make fire," Actodon announced, and immediately dug a small pit and set stones around it. I gathered bits of driftwood, some of which seemed too beautifully shaped and colored to burn. It wasn't long before Actodon had a fire going, using a flint, a stone, and twigs. Then he fetched a pot, which, like the canoe, had been made from birch bark sewn together. From the pot he pulled a squirming eel, which he threw to Miko. The little dog sank his teeth behind the eel's head, and gradually the body stopped jerking, and the dog began to eat. The second eel Actodon skewered on a long stick, which he handed to me. Then he found another stick for himself. I tried to conceal the revulsion I felt as I watched the eel I was expected to eat writhe and twist over the flame. Actodon grinned at my discomfort. "Micmac, not cookie eels," he offered, as if that would make me feel better. "I cook eels," he added proudly. Obviously pleased that he was not following this particular custom. After the eel was thoroughly browned, I stripped it from the stick and began to eat, discovering in the process how hungry I was. The eel, with its delicate, salty flavor, turned out to be delicious. After we had eaten, Actodon produced a pouch of berry juices, somewhat bitter but refreshing, and strings of dried moose meat. We finished the meal with the bread and cheese I had brought. By then, the sun had slipped behind the dark line of fir trees to the west, leaving only a pink blush in the sky. A bank of fog was moving slowly, eerily landward. I yawned. The fire, the exercise, and my full stomach had made me feel comfortably sleepy. "You go back to ship?" Actodon asked. Up till then, I had managed to forget the Queen's privateer. How enjoyable it was to be free of the terrible, threatening urgency of my uncle's plans. To continue to relax on this remote beach with someone my own age for companionship, with a temptation I did not want to resist. The temptation to stay was reinforced when I remembered my uncle's announcement that rum would flow aboard ship tonight. I certainly had no wish to be there when it did. No, I think I'll sleep here and go back to the ship tomorrow. And you?
I sleep here too, Actodon said. We talk. The white man knows much. You tell me.
And you talk, I countered. I want to learn about you too.
Actodon did not answer. He had already stood up and gone into the woods to cut down fir branches for our beds. He chose only the low bushy ones, which he stripped from the base of the tree with a rock hatchet. When he had had enough, he arranged them into a bed on either side of the fire and placed his beaver pelt on top of one and his moose skin pelt on the other. I lay down on mine, pleasantly surprised by its soft springiness, and even more pleased to discover that the fur did not irritate my sunburn. The bear grease had already begun to soothe my skin, and it was true. Though the black flies hovered around us in small clouds, they did not bite. The fog had moved into the channel, completely blocking out the island, wrapping us in a blanket. It seemed nature had personally smiled on our friendship. We had come from such different ways of life, and yet now we were enclosed in our own separate world. Curiously enough, the fog bank was not deep, and the sky above was clearly visible. We lay back and looked at the myriad stars, crowding the black night like tiny silver needle points. Actodon pointed heavenward. Star people live there, he said. It is the land beyond the skies. Everything there better. People bigger, animals too, much food. Before she drowned, my mother tells me stories about the stars. Your mother drowned? The words popped unthinkingly from my mouth before I could stop them. But Actodon responded matter-of-factly. My father too, 8 summers passed. So that explained why he was so determined to swim. My mother died when I was born, I offered. I never knew her. Your father? He on ship? No, he is dead. I forced myself to say the words. He died 6 months ago. It was the first time since my confrontation with Edward in my grandfather's kitchen that I had put the finality of his death into words. Actodon said nothing. He understood that there was nothing that could be said. For a long while, we lay silently in the dark, staring into the star-filled night, the bright coals burning between us. My eyes grew heavy with sleep. Finally, Actodon spoke. I tell you story of Muin, he said.
What's that? I murmured drowsily.
I was able to keep my eyes open long enough to see him point to the constellation we know sometimes as the Big Dipper and at other times as the Big Bear. Up there is Muin, the great she-bear, he said slowly, choosing his words carefully to get the story right. In spring, she leaves her den to journey across the sky. Chickadee, moose bird, and robin follow. Chickadee has a cooking pot. After summer gone, star hunters kill Muin with bow and arrow. They eat her meat. Chickadee, moose bird, and robin put meat in cooking pot and eat also. The bones are bare and dry, but still they stay in the sky all winter. In spring, a new she-bear leaves her den to journey across the sky. It is the same, year after year, always the same. Those words were the last I heard, for by the story's end, I was asleep. The end of chapter 14.